From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and I don't usually read the news, but something exciting just came across my phone, and I thought I would share it with you. According to the Washington Post, as of 5 minutes ago, Canada has said it will begin to ease pandemic restrictions at the U.S.-Canada border next month, allowing U.S. citizens and permanent residents living in the United States who are fully vaccinated with Canadian-authorized vaccines to enter for non-essential travel without quarantine. Decision takes effect August 9th. This is from the Washington Post. You can go check it out. But anyway, it's kind of exciting. Okay, today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with local author and yoga teacher Kyle Ferguson, whose new book is Beyond Hot Yoga, on patterns, practice, and movement. The book is co-authored by Anthony Gruden, and it's published by North Atlantic Books. Kyle Ferguson is the creator and director of Second Circle Yoga in Burlington, Vermont. Officially certified in Bikram Yoga in 2011, Kyle received additional teaching certifications in alignment-based Hatha Yoga and Yin Yoga. He is a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania's Mindfulness-Based Stress Relief Program. He has completed the Zen Mountain Monastery's Introduction to Zen Practice. In 2018, he created Second Circle Yoga in Vermont with the aim of developing a powerful, modern, scientifically informed practice for hot yoga enthusiasts everywhere. Bringing hot yoga beyond Bikram and into the 21st century, the book Beyond Hot Yoga offers a new science-backed 40-pose sequence built on up-to-date insights on bodily movement and the understanding that all bodies are different. Author, practitioner, and teacher Kyle Ferguson challenges the long-held belief that all yoga poses are right for all people. He also opens up a vital conversation regarding the principles of embodiment and interconnectedness in yoga, doing so with humor, erudition, and tongue-in-cheek wit. More than just a practice guide, Beyond Hot Yoga is a shake-it-up investigation of ideas. It encourages a new exploration of the social nature of human beings, emphasizes the harmony between physical design and mental process, and explores the philosophy of embodiment and the spiritual value of practice. Included in the book are quarantine-tailored adjustments for reaping the benefits of hot yoga sequence for when you can't get to a class, as well as tips on alignment, postures, and learning to read and listen to your body as you practice yoga. So I spoke with Kyle a little over the week ago, and I asked him to begin by reading from his book. He read a section from the very beginning called Dear Reader. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Dear reader, hello and welcome to this book. It's about yoga, sort of. Please don't get too excited. Behind this book's curtain is a relatively hairless monkey thing who watches the movies and lets the dog lick all the way inside his ear hole, who still occasionally bums cigarettes from the cool kids on restaurant patios and allows his own personal laundry to pile up, sometimes higher than he would allow guests to witness, whose excursions in the world have occasionally broken his brain a little bit. This monkey is regularly confused by the lights and the not lights all around him. "Where are the mangoes?" he asks, and he is pointed to a box of food so large he can climb his whole body inside of it. And then he can wander around the box's insides for hours on end. Often, he forgets why he is in the box. So we buy some Oreos. Word on the street is, these Oreos are vegan, which is nice, because this monkey fancies himself an exceptionally compassionate wanderer of the giant food box. There is still, for this monkey, a recurring desire to climb trees and howl at passers-by. He lives in a loop of grooming, feeding, and screeching at the other monkeys about where the boundaries are and where they should be. Every now and then, he pauses screeching and closes his eyes for a while and gets a few ideas about getting fewer ideas, which is a bit of a conundrum because he has discovered that counting ideas also counts as ideas. So, who knows? Yoga shapes make this monkey a little less confused and a little more happy. so he spends much of his time doing yoga shapes and talking to other monkeys about being less confused and more happy, and also about how sometimes things work, and sometimes they don't. How sometimes things last for a while and sometimes they don't. The mangoes will sit on the counter for weeks until little black flies start circling and the monkey goes, and then the mangoes are tossed out the door in the bag. Nothing stays the same. Of course, this monkey maintains a strange belief that he is different than, you know, monkeys. Sometimes he pretends his yoga shapes are turning him into a not monkey. Sometimes he likes to think he is the first monkey that will never die. But he is not. The Oreos are delicious and they are just Oreos. The mangoes taste sweet and then out with the bag. The yoga shapes are shapes like all the others. So don't get too excited because a mango is a mango and a breath is a breath. And behind this curtain is just a monkey thing like you that is moving in shapes upon shapes in succession, one by one like the frames in those movies. And this monkey, like all monkeys, is watching to see what stories come out of the shapes. Because behind the movies, behind the frames, behind the shapes and the monkeys, and shining through all of the curtains, there is a light. And the light becomes the story.
Great. Thank you for reading that.
Yeah.
So that was Kyle Ferguson reading from Beyond Hot Yoga on Patterns, Practice, and Movement, published by North Atlantic Books. Mm. And Kyle lives in Burlington, Vermont, and teaches in a studio that he owns in Burlington, Vermont.
Yes. Oh, and important to mention, co-written by Anthony Gruden, who is my writing partner. He's fantastic.
And I have a question about Anthony, too.
Yes.
But we'll just start with, when did you decide to write a book, and when did you start writing the book, and why?
Yeah, so on the topic of Anthony, it was actually his idea. He came out of a class that I had just taught, and he'd been a student at the studio for a couple of months. And, you know, the method that we teach at my studio is an evolution on an older method called Bikram Yoga, and he liked it and he liked the ideas behind it. And he's written a few books on art history and art criticism. And so he came up to me and was like, have you ever thought of writing a book about the ideas that built this and what you're doing here? And I don't know. I imagine that I was sort of in the place that lots of people are where you just kind of you daydream about writing a book someday, but never really consider it in a concrete fashion or start really getting into it. And I said, sure. And he was just like, let's just put together a proposal and we'll send it out to some publishers and we'll see what happens. And so I wrote 20 pages on something and he helped me put it together and sort of curate it. And then we sent it out to people. And I did not expect that anybody would actually write back. I was just like, this is a fun little exercise that I'm doing with my friend Anthony. And then North Atlantic wrote back and was like, cool, let's do this. And all of a sudden I was like, oh, crud, now I actually have to write a book. And that was, it was motivating. You know, it was these baby steps towards all of the sudden I'm on the hook for something that I did not anticipate was going to happen. Because there were only 20 pages of it when we started doing the proposal.
And when was that?
That was the winter of 2019. So I think it was December of 2019, I believe.
Okay.
Something like that. And then early 2020, we got the go ahead and it was written mostly through 2020. My timeline might be off. Anthony would correct me on this.
Yeah. Well, it was COVID, so.
Yeah, exactly. It was a fairly quick turnaround. I think that's probably off. I think it was actually earlier in 2019 that we did the proposal.
So the part that you just read, the Dear Reader part, is it's sort of pre-introduction, then you have an introduction. So I was curious about why you did both of these, and I really liked both of them, and they're different. You know, sort of like the Dear Reader part sort of shares philosophy and is funny and sort of establishes your humor throughout the book. Maybe it's a little bit more humorous than the introduction that follows, which seems to be more a story of you and yoga. And
right.
Of how, yeah. So, but why did you do two introductions?
I guess I didn't really think of the Dear Reader part as an introduction per se.
Right. It's a note to the reader.
Yeah. It's just right. A note. And for me, it came from this place of, you know, sometimes I will open yoga books or I'll, you know, listen to yoga people talking about the things that they do. And I feel a little turned off by this sense of sort of almost perfectionistic austerity or even sort of like an acceptance of imperfection that has within it this nugget of like the perfect people understand that there is imperfection, right? That there's like a right way to think, that there's a right technique, that there is, you know, a method for really figuring this out, and we are going to do that now. And I don't think that's how life works. I don't think that there's sort of that even yoga, as wonderful as it is like, now we've got the technique and we've got life figured it out, and we're going to learn together how to do the technique of figuring life out in the right way.
And we're going to live forever, not eat.
And we're going to live forever, exactly. And not eat Oreos and never bum cigarettes from people on restaurant patios and that kind of thing. And that just never sort of resonated with me and my sense of what life is and what yoga gave me. Mm-hmm. And so it was really just an attempt to offer to whoever picked up the book this notion of like, I'm not going into this with the idea that I have all of the answers. I'm not going into this trying to solve spiritual conundrums. We're not going to perfect anybody's life, right? We're not going to align energies in any particular way where all of a sudden everything is different. I'm just here to talk one organism to another organism about some ideas that I think are important.
Yeah, I liked too, though, that at the early part of the book, and I don't remember if this is part of the introduction, it might be, there are just sort of little explanations of things like, I know that there are all kinds of stories about who Bikram was.
Right.
And, you know, so I, you know, I don't want to I'm not validating him in any way. I'm not embracing him. Although I will say that that's where I started, sort of. That's what you say, right? And then there's like the cultural appropriation piece. Mm-hmm. And you have little pieces where you're sort of like, look, this comes from India. I am not from India. You know, like,
right.
I thought that was very respectful and well done.
Thank you. Yeah, I think the cultural appropriation thing is obviously very fraught. And I think the element that I most wanted to highlight is like, I don't have the answers for this, and me presenting what I present in terms of the ideas, I'm not here to be an authority in any kind of way in regards to that. I want to talk about sort of the things that I've discovered in my life, not what's going on in terms of like ancient Indian philosophy, because this is just not my place to be there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. Okay. So, not to go deeply down this rabbit hole, but let's talk a tiny bit about your background as a yoga practitioner and teacher. You did start out doing, maybe Bikram wasn't your first yoga. What was?
So, I mean, I took a yoga class at a little suburban studio in, you know, my parents' neighborhood when I was home from college.
Okay.
And I did that probably 6 or 7 times. I really liked it. But, you know, as I say in the book, I was in college and I just didn't have the time or the interest to really get into it. I got into it in earnest when I was 27 and I had just gone through a pretty difficult stage in my life where I was transitioning out of sort of one career trajectory in Los Angeles and working in entertainment. And I was,
which is why you're such a strong reader.
Yeah, that's the theater major in me. So I just done that whole sort of life was changing. I was in my, you know, mid late 20s and sort of wandering around like, what am I doing in the world? And my brother dragged me to a Bikram yoga class and I just fell in love with it immediately. And I ended up going, you know, I would go 5-6 times a week. And it, you know, for anybody who's done the sort of traditional Bikram practice, is an hour and a half long. It's very hot. So if you include travel time and showering, and it's like 3 hours out of your day. And so it changes the shape of your entire life just by having that routine. All of a sudden, 3 hours every day is dedicated to this thing.
Unless you do it twice a day, which some people
do. You do it twice a day, exactly. And so it really sort of dictates the rhythm of your life, which when you're wandering and you're lost and you don't know who you are in the world, having something dictate the rhythm of your life is really grounding. And so it was that for me, and I dove in head first, no swimmies, and just couldn't stop myself. Was in teacher training in 6 months and was gonna open a studio. You know, I had signed a lease for a studio less than a year after I took my first class. And that's sort of how the element of it becoming a professional pursuit sort of came into being.
Was that the studio in Shelburne?
No. That was way back in the day. That was in West Philadelphia. Oh. So we opened Bikram Yoga University City. My brother and I, along with another partner, we opened a studio in West Philadelphia. And it was right at the time we opened our doors, just as like the Bikram Yoga scandals were going crazy. And so, you know, we'd signed our lease for the studio when everything was cruising and it was, you know, ascending, and then our doors opened right at the bubble bursting. So it turned into a real trial, but you know, you learn a lot about people and connecting with them and the value that you can bring through routine and practice and what you can provide, particularly in a modern world where people don't have third places, where they don't know where to congregate effectively, how to meet new people. And you see that in action in a yoga studio, and you know, it feeds your heart in a real way. And so that kind of became the groundwork for the rest of my work in yoga, which was, okay, let's do the body work element of it. Let's do the bringing people together part of it. Let's do the part of it where we talk about interesting and compelling ideas so that, you know, it's not all this sort of like cloistered, whenever I'm out of my home, I have to be behaving in a particular public persona. I can investigate things with people in the world. So let's talk about ideas. You do all of those things sort of simultaneously without necessarily having to be just sort of like a mega gym or in some cases like a mega church kind of thing.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So you've changed your practice and your teaching in a number of ways since you were teaching Bikram.
Yeah.
I know Bikram, I took Bikram for a while. It has a basic script, which used to drive me crazy just from the grammar standpoint.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go back, way back, more back was one of my least favorite. So anyway, what sent you in new directions and, you know, made you want to kind of form your own practice and share your ideas?
I don't know. I have a fairly critical mind by just nature. I tend to sort of like look at my own ideas and the things that I do and the ideas of the world around me and just sort of tinker with it and try to figure out what's going on the inside. And so I started doing that with Bikram Yoga, and that sort of led me down this path where all of a sudden I started noticing that elements of the Bikram Yoga practice, which were, you know, preached as, you know, absolute, perfect for everybody kind of things, you know, the dogma, the physical dogma of the practice was highly questionable. And I would, you know, have conversations with physical therapists about things that I had been teaching for years, and they would be like, yeah, that's actually not very good for your body. And then I had encounters with students where they would have an injury, and many of the teachers in the community that I was in would tell the student to continue practicing and practice harder in the faith that practice heals the body. And then at some point they couldn't practice anymore because of the pain, and they would stop, and 3 weeks later their pain would go away, and they would come back and start practicing again. The pain would come back, and you know, to you and me talking right now, it feels super obvious, like the practice is causing the pain and so you need to stop the practice, all this kind of thing. But inside of this dogmatic structure, there was this weird confusion about what to do.
Right.
And I watched this happen a few times, and I started changing some of the cues and the language and the directions for the standard Bikram practice. I sort of went a little renegade. And people who had sort of chronic injuries or conditions that happened due to their practice, those things started going away. And so I thought that I could sort of do this from inside the Bikram world. I would be like, cool, I'm going to present these things to the Bikram world. So I actually wrote a new Bikram yoga dialogue and I gave it away to all the teachers for free. And you know, some people liked it, but there was a lot of backlash, you know, on the Facebook message boards about how I was not a Bikram teacher anymore and all this kind of stuff. And I'm like, fine,
okay.
And at a certain point, you realize you just have to step outside of the bubble and...
Or the cult, as the case may be.
Right. Yeah, is hyper-dogmatic thinking that I was finding really problematic. And so I was like, okay, this can't be reformed from the inside. There's too much attachment to various elements of it. And so go outside of it and see if you can figure out how to present something different. And that's how Foundations came about. I took information that I'd gathered from outside of the Bikram world, and I essentially took the entire Bikram practice and just replaced poses and replaced commands and changed the standards and built this thing and was like, I think this will work better. And I started teaching it to people up here in Burlington.
Cool. And you do call it Foundation, and I have a thing later, which I'm going to jump to now. Okay, so it's short for Foundations of Repatterning.
Yeah.
The process of intentionally modifying habitual patterns through intelligent routine action.
Yeah.
I took that out of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I love the thing that you say, which is shift patterns, don't chase poses.
Yeah.
Which I think is sort of similar to what you were saying about the people who are getting hurt, you know, don't go for depth and don't always go as hard as you possibly can.
Yeah, yeah. So depth seeking, I think, is not a problem that is exclusive to Bikram. I think it's throughout the yoga world. There's this weird, I see what seems to be a fairly schizophrenic approach to depth, where you'll have, you know, like a yoga magazine with an article about not going too deep in your poses, or like watching, you know, your body and taking care of it in a way that's very intelligent. And then on the cover of that yoga magazine is a person with their foot behind their head or something. And you go, okay, like what are the standards that we're presenting here? You know, is the side straddle split? Is that for everybody? What are we projecting out into the world? And it felt like there was a very mixed message essentially as to what the goal of a yoga practice is. Mm-hmm. And I found it difficult sort of watching this practice that many people approach in a very, very physical way. Having the standards of sort of spirituality or emotional development kind of wash over the physical practice in a way that justified doing whatever the teacher told you because it would had some spiritual or emotional value. So you never really had to investigate like what is truly happening in the human body when you do this shape.
Mm-hmm.
And is this shape good for all human bodies? Should you be teaching it to groups?
Mm-hmm.
And the more I looked at that, it just seemed like, look, if you're going to do the spiritual or emotional stuff, that's fantastic. Let's make sure that you're doing it with postures and a physical approach that is more broadly safe.
Mm-hmm.
and has very clear standards for what you're trying to do with the bodies of your students.
Mm-hmm.
And in your own practice.
And just to like step back to something that kind of came up spontaneously when we were talking about your practice foundations, the foundation of repatterning is looking at patterns, and you say, you know, people have habits in the way that they work or work out or just live.
Mm-hmm.
That may or may not be good for them.
Sure.
And may be habitual more than thoughtful. And as one of the ones you mentioned is the left ankle sprain pattern, you know, which is actually a pattern for me. Like I sprained my
me
ankle
too.
In college, and then it just happened again and
yep.
again and again. So I like that. And I like the idea of repatterning, both mentally and physically. So I wonder if there's an example that you can offer of a correction that you might offer to a student who could benefit from reconsidering a certain pose. Like I was thinking of Cobra. Like, is there something you teach again and again and again, because it's something.
Oh, that's the perfect example.
Okay.
Cobra's the perfect example. So I don't know. It's difficult to do this in audio, but we can go for it. We're all aware of forward head carriage, right? Where your head moves forward of your shoulders. So we're all pretty aware of it, that like having your head hunched forward of your shoulders isn't very good for you. And it's associated with using computers and sitting down and having your cell phone and driving in your car, where you have this position where the skull moves forward of you know, the line of gravity. One of the things that we want to pay attention to in that head position is that the back of your neck shortens relative to what we might call a neutral position, right? The back of your skull gets closer to, you know, your shoulders, essentially. Mm-hmm. And the front of your neck lengthens and releases. This is not a problem in terms of just moving around the world and sitting down in, you know, normal situations. But if it becomes an ingrained pattern where the back of the neck is shortened, that's a problem, because you're now going to be gripped in forward head carriage. It's going to be harder to get out of it.
Can you see those people? You see the people that have, I don't mean just you in yoga class, but we see them walking down the street.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, my opinion is it's probably 97% of people in the modern world have some form of forward head carriage. You know, like I've got a little, I spend time in chairs.
Well, you said in the book, our heads are basically the size and weight of a bowling ball.
Right.
And when you wrote that, I'm like, oh my God, that's true.
Yeah. Yeah. It's sort of these like basic realities of the body that when you start incorporating them, it gets kind of wild to actually think about. But in terms of cobra, right? In cobra, you're lying on your belly and you lift off of the floor in a back bend. And lots of people will essentially do forward head carriage practice in cobra, because they've got that tight back of the neck pattern. When they go up, they'll just grip the back of the neck inside the yoga pose. Mm. And so if they're thinking that the goal of the yoga pose is to lift their chest and look up as much as they can, then they'll be looking up and gripping the back of their neck the whole time. Well, if I have a student who has forward head carriage and the back of their neck is pretty consistently gripped, I don't want to train them to grip it more. That's not something that I'm going for. So if I'm assessing cobra as like the goal is the pose, then it's just get as high as you can, look up as much as you can, because that's the pose. But if I'm assessing it according to patterns, it's a different game of like, what pattern is my student bringing into the class, and how can I do work that helps modify that in a way that's healthy for them?
And so would you perhaps tell them to look something other than up, like, mm-hmm. you know, 4 feet away on the floor?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So when we do cobra in foundations, we start with the forehead down on the floor too. So you're lying with your face smushed against the mat. And that's primarily so that you get that starting position of the back of your neck is
healthy.
Long.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're towards a more neutral position. And then we try to lift in that neutral position as you come up.
So I should mention that the book has a lot of really instructive pose photos, which is helpful, more helpful probably than people trying to listen on the radio. But I thought you did that very well.
Thank you.
So it mostly these pictures mostly feature teachers in your studio. Apart from just the practice of yoga, can you talk about the craft of writing the book and the photography? Putting together the book, did the publisher arrange for photos? Did you hire a photographer yourself?
We did the photos, yeah.
You did the photos, okay.
Yeah, we did the photos. It was the Second Circle teachers and a few students who had taken our teacher development program, and just some other students who had been in the practice and were committed and sort of part of the inner circle, the family. And we got all together on one day. We had a photographer.
Really?
Yeah, we had a photographer who had done my friend's wedding. Andy Dubeck.
Yeah.
He was a great guy, and he came in and, you know, banged it out very quickly. We just ran people through. So those are actually the banner photos for each pose. You know, each pose has a "this is what the pose is" picture.
Right, right.
And Andy did all of those. And then the other sort of like little instructional photos and modifications and all those kinds of things, those are just me on an iPhone 6.
I wondered.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not because they don't look good. I just thought, you know, it's not that hard to shoot pretty good pictures with an iPhone anymore. The thing I loved is, and I am familiar and I'm acquainted with some of these people, and I loved sort of the shots where you can tell that they're like, not laughing.
Yeah.
I'm not laughing. You're laughing. I'm not laughing.
part of the fun is that I am off camera in all of these shots, kind of heckling them about, you know, do this for the pose. We got to make it look great for the book. And we're just having a great time.
Yeah, it looked like it.
Yeah. It's a funny thing about the cell phone camera thing was we got a note on photography from the publisher that specifically said, don't use your cell phone to take your pictures because the image quality won't be good enough. And I was like, I'm gonna test this.
Okay, but how are these?
Yeah, exactly. And I sent them over. They were like, they're great. So sorry, Jillian. I got you on that one.
Okay, I want to talk about the structure of the book. Again, because from the craft perspective of writing, I thought it works really well.
Thank you.
You have chapters, mm-hmm. and those chapters are instructive. They, even before you get to the poses, you talk a lot about your philosophy and mm-hmm. some of the issues we've already covered about approach and why you wanted to develop your foundations practice. Then there are sidebars and there are footnotes, and the footnotes are really funny a lot of the time. Although I disagree with you that you could sort of skip the footnotes. I felt like some of them were really, really good. And
well,
I was
I'm
like,
glad.
Oh, some of them are really helpful.
I'm glad.
So did you come up with that? Did your publisher help you figure out where...
The footnote thing?
No, just the whole structure of the book and where things were going to go and having... Because there's a lot to look at, which I think is helpful when it comes to an instructive book.
Yeah. That was... I guess it was a happy accident that it turned out to be helpful because it's really just... the way that my brain works.
The footnotes, you mean, or?
The footnotes and the inserts and all the kinds of things. I would find that, I want to make sure that I talk about this thing and it's relevant, but it doesn't exactly fit in the flow of this. So I'm just going to write this thing on the side.
Yeah, but that's fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the footnotes were mostly, it probably doesn't make sense to put this into the paragraph, but I'm having fun and here's a joke and here's how I'm entertaining myself in this moment.
I should do an example of a footnote so people know what we're talking about. Is that okay with you?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, let's see. Efficiency means, in this case, that the organism doesn't spend any more energy than it has to survive. You spend too much energy, you need too much food, you starve. So living things have an evolutionary pressure to use no more energy than absolutely necessary to survive. And then the footnote is, some species have figured a way around this. Porcupines, for example, are dull and lazy and almost entirely clueless wastes of space and tree bark, which is fine for them because their skin is a hellish bed of nightmare death needles and predators for such quarry are scarce. So it's true, but it's also funny.
Yeah, I'm glad.
But the book itself is funny. Like a lot of the book is. I liked that so much because you were very respectful and didn't go critical when you were talking about other yoga books. But I think that other yoga books, that thing that they're doing where they're telling you we're going to get this right, is also slightly condescending sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I found this to be so inclusive and warm and just fun.
I'm glad. Yeah, thank you. I one of the things that, you know, you spend enough time along any of these sort of paths of people trying to figure things out or figure the rules of life out or anything is, you know, anytime somebody tells you they've got the answers, run the opposite way as fast as you can, you know.
Exactly. Okay, tell us about yoga for human beings.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's sort of to the point of not exactly having everything figured out and not pretending that we do.
Yeah.
You know, the term that I use in the book and is, you know, sparkly, perfect angel yoga people. which, you know, you get out into the world and the notion of a person who does yoga comes with all of these sort of cultural associations, whether they're real or not. You know, I'll walk into a party where I did once in the world before, you know, you'll go in a social situation and you'll tell someone that you're a yoga teacher and all of a sudden they'll look at you and they'll like stand up differently. And as if there's all of these, you know, weird expectations or judgments coming from my end about like how you are showing up in the world and whether you're spiritual enough or perfect enough or, you know, whether your body is sufficient or whatever. And you know, I really hate that stuff. We're human beings. We're responding to the conditions of our environment the best that we can. We screw up. Sometimes, you know, we do things like we hurt other people. We hurt ourselves. There's a lot of doubt and confusion in being a person, particularly in the modern world. And I don't think it helps anybody to sort of pretend, that there's this element of angelic certainty that we can arrive at. And I think that even shows up, as I mentioned before, in the sort of like, it's okay to be imperfect conversation. That to me still feels like this conversation saying like, you know, sometimes it can feel like someone telling you it's okay to be imperfect is them like dictating the rules of imperfect is okay. Does that,
it's like a little wink, wink.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's like, we know, cause it's okay to be imperfect.
And
it's
like, we know what imperfect looks like.
like I'm less confused or I'm less worried about my imperfections than I am just about the confusion of being a thing that is alive.
Right. You credit Anthony Gruden, and you already talked about him.
Yes.
So what was his role in writing the book?
Well, I think initially the plan was for him to kind of, I think we both envisioned that we would do this thing where we would go into a room together for 3 hours twice a week, and I would go over my yoga teaching notes and my ideas, and we would have conversations, and we'd sit next to, you know, our ticker tape machine and put together a book based on all of that. And for various reasons, perhaps you can notice just in the way that I talk, it turned into, I would just sort of word vomit content onto the page, and then I'd send it to Anthony, like pleading for his approval, like, does this make sense? And he, as I said in the acknowledgments, he was a wonderful and careful shepherd to the rabid flock of emus that is my mind, where I imagine that being a writer takes two very specific, skills. And one is just the capacity to generate content. Mm. And the other is the capacity to take that content and organize it and keep it coherent and form it into something that makes sense. And the former I have, I can do content. I can put words into the world very easily. Mm-hmm. But the work of making it coherent and holding it together and holding it to a structure and making it a book, that to me, Anthony really showed up in that way of taking the craziness and being like, okay, let's move this and let's follow this and not follow that. And doing a fair bit of taking things and rewriting them so they made more sense. But I would say that like sort of the primary role was like handler. Like,
now, how did you react to, did he veto any of your footnotes, for example, or did he say, that's not funny?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the best parts about having a working relationship with someone like Anthony is that he is a quiet genius. And so whenever he was like, this probably doesn't work, I'd be, he was always right. And so that was really nice to have a person who not only I felt whose sort of like intellect and contributions I could trust, was also just in on the work and understood what was happening. And, you know, now I consider a very dear friend.
That's great. Yeah. Now, you just said this about like, you take your ideas and you kind of like would throw them at the page. But I was wondering, as you worked, were you also doing research, if only to kind of look up a thing that you've always thought was true?
Totally.
So where were you researching? Like mostly online?
There was a bunch of online research. A lot of it was consulting sort of yoga books and anatomy books that I kind of keep on hand and try to make the water that I swim in as a yoga teacher just have these things nearby and be consulting them regularly. One of the fun little first edition moments in this book is that there's a whole appendix in it of recommended reading, mm-hmm. that got deleted.
Oh.
And it's mentioned in the introduction and then it doesn't exist in the book.
You should put it on the website or something.
Yeah. So that's an important thing. But, you know, there were encyclopedias of Sanskrit terms and anatomy books. Mm. You know, Thomas Meyer's Anatomy Trains was deeply influential to the work that I do and how I approach patterns and patterning. So there were, you know, sort of a desk with the books around and on the floor, and also, you know, very much the internet.
Let's see. Some of my questions we've already kind of talked about, so I'm not asking every single one. But I did want to talk about the rule of three.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's funny because as we relate it to yoga, it's very valuable to a yoga practice. But I liked how you opened it, which was relating it to social media.
Yeah.
In the way that, you know, you might state something online and somebody comes back at you, or you might see something online, disagree with it, and want to have a conversation, and eventually it can like ramp up into a great argument.
Yeah.
But then I loved where you were sort of like, and then there comes that point where your nemesis, as you call the other opinion, makes a point that you actually agree with, and you're so agitated that you're not really in the mind space to be able to agree with this person.
Yeah.
But it's valuable. And it was really interesting. Yeah. So that was how you came to the idea of the rule of three, which is there's a point, there's a counterpoint, and there's the relationship between them.
Yeah. Well.
And I've kind of simplified that in a not great way, but go.
No, absolutely. Go. I mean, that explanation of it in the social media thing is personal experience of having online Facebook conversations with, you know, conservatives with whom I disagree.
Friends or trolls?
Most friends of friends, right? Because I went to school in Virginia, and so I have lots of friends who are from various parts of Virginia, and they, you know, their Facebook feeds include, you know, people from all over, from essentially sort of social and political backgrounds that I don't share. But I'd be in the middle of these Facebook arguments, and all of the sudden be provided with information that proved me wrong. And
then you're like, no.
And I'd freeze. I would freeze and I would realize that my mind was looking for a way out, was looking for a way to be like, no, I don't have to change. No, nothing has to, you know, like you're wrong or I'm going to change the topic. And if I wanted to be intellectually honest in that moment, I would just have to take the loss.
Mm-hmm.
And that moment of letting that tension shift the way that you think, shift your sense of the world, like not running away from that moment of tension and trying to change the topic, but really sitting with it. I think that's where you get, you know, the most value out of sort of being a thinking person is letting that tension confront you
right.
a little bit. And that's the tension between the counterpoints.
Right.
That idea is, credit where it's due, was first presented to me in, I think, different language, from a teacher of mine named Jenny LaRosa in Philadelphia, when she was talking about yoga philosophy
mm-hmm.
and sort of, you have a thing and its counterpoint, but the real juice is in the interaction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in that case, it's sort of like maybe a move or a position.
Yeah.
And it's like, do you want to just talk a little more about what that looks like?
Yeah. So in terms of yoga, I mean, one of the simplest ones that I like to talk about is if you're doing like a standing backbend where you're leaning your body over backwards, it's really helpful and functional to actually turn your body on like you're trying to bend forward. So if you go into a backbend and then imagine doing a sit-up while you're doing a backbend, the muscles in the front side of your body turn on and they start to support you and they create lift in your spine. So you're going one way, you're acting in the other direction, and the meeting of those two opposites creates support in the posture. Instead of it's all one way, it's all back, it's all drop, it's right. all depth. You take.
Go back, more back, way back.
Yeah, go back, more back, way back, fall over, your neck should hurt, all that stuff. If you instead just say, okay, we're going back and we're also going to counter it. We're going to add the going forward impulse into the going back action. And when they meet, that's where we're going to get the value of the work.
Right. It reminds me a little bit of leaning forward when you're skiing down a mountain and you're like, that seems wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But all right, great. Let's see. Okay. So yoga is hard work sometimes.
Yeah.
Right?
Can be.
And this is my like silly little note, but we aren't all farmers anymore. I think that sometimes culturally we avoid physical work. Not everybody, but I think still a lot of people. One of your sidebars talks about how good posture can be exhausting. So
yeah.
Like, what do you say to somebody who avoids yoga because he tried it once and it was really hard, or just generally to people whose work regularly sort of confines them to office chairs, like you talked about in one of the many places in the book? You know, like just sort of, I don't know, your philosophy on hard work and fixing your body so that life is easier.
Yeah. To the first question of like, what do you say to someone who doesn't want to do yoga or took it once and didn't like it? My experience is you just let those people do whatever they want to do.
Right.
You know, like trying to convince somebody to do yoga. I've spent a decade doing it and they have to find it on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe in that. And I trust people will find it when it works for them. And if it doesn't work for them, then, you know, go find something that does. I think that the sort of the central reality, if we want to get philosophical, is that life is always going to have pain.
Mm-hmm.
And the real work is choosing which pain or, you know, investment of your energy or your exhaustion. You know, if hard work in the yoga room is difficult for you, that can be sort of a sense of, this is a difficulty that I'm going to choose. I'm choosing it because it has a result that I can be somewhat in charge of, instead of sort of receiving or being reactionary to sort of difficulty and pain that is outside of your control. So I find that that's the work of an intentional or, you know, who am I to say, but like a spiritual life, which is acknowledging it's always going to be difficult. There's going to be pain. There are going to be things that will hurt you. But if you engage in the difficulty with intention, and sort of a direction that you choose, then you can find sort of greater value in the way that you move through the difficulties.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's sort of like a broad strokes answer to the, we're not farmers anymore, but you know, I wouldn't wish indentured servitude in an agricultural setting on anybody. So I'm not trying to get back to we're all farmers exactly.
Right. I don't want to finish without asking you about your decision to back off the heat in your studio recently.
Yeah.
So
initially the heat had, you know, various benefits, one of which is that just extreme circumstances create bonds between people. And for me, as I said earlier, the fundamental value I find, or one of the fundamental values rather, in having a yoga studio or a yoga community is bringing people together. And when they share something like, wow, that was really hard, and they were all doing it together, there's this sense of camaraderie that develops. And that's what I felt through the Bikram yoga world. And there are some, you know, moderate physical benefits to it as well. But for me, it was really sort of creating the conditions of developing camaraderie was the point of the heat. And that's real and that is valuable. But I don't know, it's 2021 and I didn't feel like I could any longer justify to myself running a business that was predicated on excessive energy usage.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, in the world of global climate change, I know turning off the heat at my studio isn't going to save the world, but I wouldn't own a private airline. You know, I wouldn't be the owner of a private meat packing company. And it didn't feel right to be the owner of a hot box for affluent people in the global north, while the world is changing and less fortunate people are going to be hurt by sort of reckless decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, it was really more about introducing to the people who are in my community and to myself, the work of sacrifice, of giving something up, of making intentional decisions about the effects that we have on the world, the network effects that we have on the world, how we influence those around us, how we influence the globe and the environment, and really sort of taking that on in a direct way, like sitting with the tension and letting the tension change you.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was writing the book, you know, the original title of the book was Hot Yoga for Human Beings.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was writing the book, the Black Lives Matter protests were going on and COVID was raging. And there was this broad cultural conversation, or two conversations, one of which was, why doesn't anybody listen to the scientists? And the other was, you have to be willing to change fundamentally the way that you think in order to enact justice in the world. And those two conversations were sitting in my brain as I had turned off the heat in my studio for you know, lockdowns. And I went, well, I'm just not going to turn that heat back on because I have to change the way that I think in order to enact justice. And I have to listen to the scientists.
Right. And you, it's interesting because you say my turning off the heat isn't going to change the world. But I do think that the carbon footprint being a kind of personal reflection, right, each of us has to think about what we're doing to the planet. And all of us together do change things.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's tough because the conversation around climate change obviously gets very complex because it isn't an individual problem. It's a social and a cultural and a civilizational problem. And it's really an economic problem, right? And it boils down to sort of the, you know, capitalist influences on energy production. But in order to get to those conversations, right now you and I are sort of talking through that kind of stuff because of the individual decision to change something that people went, why would you change that? And I think that having more conversations about, you know, the incentive structures for oil companies are really bad and they're destroying the planet. I think that's an important conversation that all of us try to broadcast out into the world, because this is an important moment. It's a very, very important moment in human history. So, you know, if you can turn off the heat at your studio and then all of a sudden one day you're on a podcast talking about, you know.
Right. It's not just the two of us here.
Disassemble BP and Exxon. That's great.
I always like to ask people what they've read lately that they might recommend to listeners. Usually I just like 1 to 3 titles.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The Age of Surveillance Capitalism.
Okay.
By Shoshana Zuboff is fascinating and a bit terrifying. It's about sort of the development of the modern internet money structure, how Google and Facebook essentially are more than selling your data, they're selling influence on the future. And then the other is A Paradise Built in Hell by Rebecca Solnit.
Oh yeah, she's awesome.
She's fantastic. I think she's one of the smarter people writing today. And that's about how human beings come together in the wake of disasters, how we tend to have perhaps a cultural narrative and a Hollywood movie narrative about, oh no, society just collapsed because of an earthquake and now there's rioting and looting and everybody's turning into these like feral monsters and everyone's turning on one another. And what we actually see in reality in the wake of things like Katrina is, oh wait, these people are rallying around one another and like, yeah, you can find looters, but the vast majority of people are actually coming together to support one another when the sort of social systems that they were relying on before fall apart. I mean, there's just this wonderful impulse towards community. And so I think it's absolutely fascinating. And the other is The Patterning Instinct by... Oh, I'm going to say this wrong. The other is The Patterning Instinct by Jeremy Lent and Fritjof Capra, subtitled A Cultural History of Humanity's Search for Meaning. Really cool. It sort of dives into the history, particularly of Western philosophy and monotheism and how we sort of got to the cultural moment that we're in and the ideological and philosophical influences that are at play largely in the sort of cultural subconscious and, you know, our ideas like individualism and meritocracy and, you know, the nation, how these things came together and what they mean and their background in history. It's absolutely fascinating.
Okay, great. Are you going to write anything more or are you?
I'm already doing
again?
It.
You are.
I'm already doing it. I'm addicted now. I think one of the wonderful things about, you know, seeing a book show up in print in front of you is this sense of it demystifies it. You know, it's, oh, this can be done.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm writing something now just having to do with the ways in which the mind is propagandized in the world and sort of messaging and advertising and how that shows up. And it's actually intended for, you know, for me, for an audience of me, like straight white men, essentially, where it's talking about the incentive structures that we're responding to and how we end up with various mythologies about ourselves and about culture and about others and who those mythologies serve and why we believe the things that we do and what it means for our hearts and our place in our communities. And it's an attempt to investigate sort of the assumed beliefs about things like culture and masculinity and how we can unpack those in service to our communities and to our own spirits.
Mm-hmm. That sounds wonderful.
Yeah.
Is that going to follow the same format as far as writing a nonfiction book proposal, getting a publisher, and then finishing the book, or are you just writing?
I'm just writing right now. It has not done the whole proposal thing. I haven't put it in front of, you know, the editor at North Atlantic who I worked with or anything like that. I don't know if it fits their vibe. They do, you know, wellness books mostly. In the stage where it is right now, it's just getting the content out. You know, I'm feeling the content moving.
Figuring out what you're writing.
Yeah, exactly. Sort of. I'm figuring out what I'm writing. Right. It's and when it's coming out of me, trying to, you know, I just let it roll.
Okay, I'm going to credit my husband for this one, who knows you also.
Yeah, Jerry.
So he listens to me every week say to mostly fiction writers that I don't like to do spoilers, and so I don't spoil endings of books, but... in the case of Beyond Hot Yoga, how does it end?
How does it end?
That was Jerry's contribution.
That's great. How does it end? There's a great big wedding. It's on a boat. No. I think it ends. I mean, the ending of the book is the statement about interconnectedness and climate change and our influence on the world around us and how it's important to sort of take stock of who we are, where we are, the influence that we have, and how we can choose to engage the world differently. And then sort of the epilogue is just, I would say it's a little sliver. It's kind of the counterpoint to Dear Reader. Mm-hmm. It's much more sincere and less ironic, and it's really just about acknowledging influence and how there is choice and control inside of influence, but also just a vastness of unknowing in terms of what our influence might be.
Cool. Wonderful. You did that very well without actually spoiling it.
Thank you.
My last question is always about advice. And in your case, I thought I would ask if you have any advice for people who haven't in the past necessarily identified themselves as writers, but who want to write about their work or their passions or their philosophies on a subject of particular interest. Like, what's your advice to those people?
Yeah, I think what I found most interesting in this process was that I'm so surrounded by this kind of content and this kind of information that much of what ended up in the book, you know, almost all of it was just stuff that I was already thinking, that I was already talking to people about. I was already saying it in my yoga classes. And so it really just became the work of writing down what was already happening for me and what I was already presenting. And I think I expected, I think that I feared that because it was normal to me, it would be completely normal to everybody else. And that it wouldn't like have great value because it's just part of my life. And it doesn't change me to have this information. It doesn't change my mind because it's been inside of my mind. And so it feels very normal and unexceptional and uninteresting when it's bouncing around inside of my brain because that's just my brain. And the process was really just write down your brain. Just write down the things that are already normally happening inside of your brain and don't try to make them into some more special, sparkly version, right? Mm-hmm. If you've got experience in a certain field, just write down the things that are already happening. And that was what was really freeing for me, was the realization that I didn't have to like make up new perspectives about my work. I just got to write down exactly what I'd already been saying and where I was. And all of a sudden it was just, well, yeah, I've been saying this and this is what I think about and I'll just put it down.
Yeah. That's great. Wonderful advice. Okay, I'm going to just say one more time. I've been speaking with Kyle Ferguson, who, along with Anthony Gruden, wrote a book called Beyond Hot Yoga on Patterns, Practice, and Movement. The book is published by North Atlantic Books, and Kyle's yoga studio is in Burlington, Vermont, and it is Second Circle Yoga. Thank you very much.
Thank you. This was awesome.
From the Media Factory, in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with local author and yoga teacher Kyle Ferguson. As with many professionals, he has a set of letters after his name that concern his education and qualifications. E-R-Y-T 200. I looked it up and I learned that this means that Kyle has done a whole lot of yoga. We already knew that, but he's done a lot of yoga training and practice. You can learn more about his work at secondcircleyoga.com. One concept discussed in the book is that of flipping an established practice, turning it on its head, you might say, to explore the power of opposition. So I started thinking, can we do this in a writing exercise? This week, look at your work. What is a pattern for which you regularly reach? Do you always write in the morning and find it's not flowing lately? In that case, maybe write after lunch or last thing at night. Maybe write in a notebook rather than on the laptop. Craft-wise, do you start every scene mid-dialogue? Or do you use the same tired gestures for your main character? How might you flip those patterns to explore the power of opposition? Perhaps you could begin a scene at the end of an important action and find a way other than dialogue to present what has happened. Maybe your character avoids her reflection for once in the window. Maybe she reaches for her younger sister's hand instead of a cigarette. Would she never do that? Why not? If it's not consistent with her character, what other than a cigarette will work? I have no idea what your normal habits and patterns are, but this week, consider ways to flip your practice, your writing practice. Repattern your habits and freshen both the words on the page and the stories that they tell. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. If you like the show, please rate it where you get your podcasts, like it on Facebook, and talk about it. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.